From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, genius and schizophrenia in the new movie Proof. We'll meet director John Madden. His latest film, starring Anthony Hopkins and Gwyneth Paltrow, is based on a Pulitzer Prize-winning Broadway play. Madden also directed Shakespeare in Love, which won 7 Oscars, including Best Picture. Also, actor Tom Wilkinson. Best known for The Full Monty and In the Bedroom, he's starring in 2 new films, The Exorcism of Emily Rose and Separate Lies with Emily Watson. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Everything is Illuminated, starring Elijah Wood. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. John Madden is a veteran director of stage, television, and screen. His best-known work is the film Shakespeare in Love, which won 7 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. British by birth, Madden has worked on both sides of the Atlantic for nearly 30 years. His other feature films include Ethan Frome, Captain Corelli's Mandolin, and Mrs. Brown. His new film, Proof, is based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning play by David Auburn. Before making the film version, Madden directed the London stage production of the play. Both the film and the London production starred Gwyneth Paltrow. Paltrow plays Catherine, a woman in her 20s coping with the illness and death of her father, a brilliant mathematician who suffered from schizophrenia. Catherine cared for her deteriorating father while pursuing her own career in theoretical math. She worries she may have inherited his mental illness. In this scene from Proof, Catherine is talking to her father, played by Anthony Hopkins.
How old were you when it started?
What?
You know, when you got sick.
26, 27. Is that what you wondered about?
I've thought about it.
Just because I went bughouse doesn't mean you will. This stuff is not strictly hereditary. They know that now. Listen to me. Life changes fast in your 20s, and it shakes you up. You're feeling down. It's been a bad week. You've had a lousy couple of years. No one knows that better than me. You're going to be okay.
I am.
Yes, I promise you. The simple fact that we can talk about this together is a good sign.
A good sign?
Yeah.
Oh, how could it be a good sign?
Because crazy people don't sit around wondering if they're nuts.
They don't?
Of course not. They've got better things to do. Take it from me. A very good sign that you're crazy is an inability to ask the question, am I crazy?
Even if the answer is yes?
Crazy people don't ask, you see?
Huh.
So come on, what do you say? Let's call it a match. You go up and get some sleep, and then in the morning you...
Wait.
What's the matter?
It doesn't make sense.
Sure it does.
No.
Where's the problem?
The problem is you are crazy.
So?
So, you said a crazy person would never admit that.
Ah, I see.
So?
It's a point.
Anthony Hopkins and Gwyneth Paltrow in the new film Proof, directed by my guest John Madden. I asked him what made him want to bring this story from the stage to the screen.
Partly that the fact that it's rather unusual material for a film. You know, you're seeing a character under intense pressure, under the pressure of bereavement, not just any bereavement, but the loss of somebody with whom she was entirely symbiotic at that point, because she'd given up most of her adult life, or a good part of her adult life, supporting her father and try and halt his decline, his slide into serious mental disorder. And so you're dealing with a character who's lost her sense of self and so forth. She doesn't quite know who she is. She doesn't know where her father ends and where she begins. She doesn't know how to live now without him. She shares some of his talent and interest in mathematics. And she's been trying to give him the illusion that he is still working by working alongside him. But most particularly, she sort of lost her grip on a certain kind of reality. Without giving the game away, that conversation you hear them having, which is a very strange conversation where he's assuring her that a good sign that she's not crazy is the fact that she's even worrying about it. And she points out that he is crazy, so that disproves his theory. Is a kind of marvelous glimpse into some of the things that are going on, which is... Among them are, you know, is she crazy herself? Is she about to, or is she already way down the slope of mental instability and going towards where her father was? Is she a reliable witness of her own experience? Is what she remembers true or not true? And these, of course, relate to the central mystery of the story, because it's a mystery story.
I read that when Gwyneth Paltrow performed that role in London on the stage, her father was then living.
Mm-hmm.
When she performed the film, in the film, her father had died. Of course,
yes, with a horrible kind of congruity. Yes, that's absolutely true. When
did you see a different kind of performance? Do you think it gave a depth or insight that?
Well, it certainly did, and it certainly did for her, because I think that, you know, look, as an actress, I think she certainly would attest to a difference, and she may be selling herself short as an actress because actually, it was a completely unfettered emotional performance on stage, which is pretty devastating to perform and to watch as well. And then she was, I think, drawing on the fear of her father's death because he had several encounters, several bouts with cancer at that point, although that was not eventually what he died from. He died from a pneumonia that was related to the cancer or had come about because of the cancer. He and Blythe Danner came to see her in a very early performance, and that day is very vividly etched on my mind. And then he died between doing the play and doing the film. So then she was, as it were, going back into something she already knew, but now with this sort of subtle shift that it was a fact. All of those emotions, or the kind of range, the spectrum of emotions that implies, are implicit in what the character's doing as well, because she goes through, I suppose, not accepting his death in a sort of state of denial about his death, then having to accept his death as a fact, and so on. So it's very hard to describe what the difference is. I think it's only that it's like she's stripped away several more layers of skin between doing the play and doing the film. It's just a very naked kind of performance. The pain is very visible.
One of the interesting things about the material in this play is that it involves a brilliant mathematician, and we learn when we get into the world of theoretical math that, like any other world, there is competition and there are stars and there are posers. I'm wondering, what did that appeal to you, kind of getting into this other world?
I love that. There's a sort of keyhole effect you do in any movie, where what I call the keyhole effect, which is the sort of pleasure of looking into a world that you don't know anything about. As a director, it's incumbent on you to kind of try and understand or as much about that world as you can. It's research, basically. But, you know, it's what part of the pleasure of, say, you know, Mrs. Brown seeing the royal family when it isn't the royal family, or the queen when she wasn't a queen, or seeing what it was like backstage at a Shakespeare play. That kind of thing is terribly interesting and fascinating, hopefully for an audience as well as a thing. And likewise, as you say, mathematics, the idea that they party, that they take drugs, as you say, that there's competition, that people feel like second raters and other people are stars, and there's hero worship. The words that they use to describe the work that they're doing is so kind of fascinating. We think of it as being such a dry, geeky, academic subject. And one of the very nice things that the play observes is that it isn't that way. There's a point which I know always gets a laugh, both in the theater and with the movie, I've noticed, where Hal, the character that Jake Gyllenhaal plays, who is a grad student who believes himself to be a second rater because he's already over the hill at the age of 26, is talking about a proof that is, central to the story. And he declares, he tried to describe the proof. He says the proof is very hip. And an audience always laughs at that. For a long time, I didn't quite understand why, but it's because it's the conjunction of the word hip with the idea of higher mathematics seem completely incompatible concepts to people, but they're not, because the cutting edge of mathematics is extremely modern, extremely exciting, pioneering stuff.
My guest is director John Madden. His latest film is Proof. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Madden. He is a director of many films, including Shakespeare in Love. His latest is called Proof. Your film Shakespeare in Love was an extraordinary success. And one of the things that I loved about it was that it sort of gives us this look at Elizabethan London, which isn't pretty. I mean, it's noisy and chaotic and
smelly
and kind of dangerous. And tell us about creating this world of Elizabethan London, the details.
Obviously, there's an enormous amount of clues to all of this in the plays themselves, which make references that sometimes are lost on us, and so we drew on a lot of that. You know, one of the glorious things about the piece was the sort of spirit of an anachronism, I suppose, that Tom Stoppard in particular kind of relished and pursued into every available kind of crevice in the material.
What do you mean by that anachronism?
Well, the story takes place both in the Elizabethan time and also in the modern time, because in a very obvious sense, it was the beginning of show business. That's one of the things that it posits, that you know, had Shakespeare been alive today, he'd have been a contract writer for Warner Brothers, probably. and so the whole idea that the acting profession, the notion of stars and celebrities and budgets and going over budget and falling behind deadlines and all of this kind of thing was all sort of built into the story. And, you know, we as you said in your introduction, we were very anxious to create a world that was not that kind of pristine world that one somehow imagines in period pieces, perhaps even from Shakespeare plays. It's just teeming. It's full of low life. You're sharing space with animals. People are throwing feces out of the window, and you have to keep your wits about you to make sure they don't land on you. That kind of thing. They were writing with ink, which they couldn't get off their fingers. We kind of pursued a reality into every corner, into every crevice.
I know that you directed a lot of Shakespeare earlier in your career.
Yeah.
Did you envision this being the Will Shakespeare? I mean, did you kind of?
No, because I mean, one did and one didn't. The lovely thing about this had this sort of doubleness all the time, that it was so glorious that it was completely disrespectful about Shakespeare and the world, in the sense that it didn't mind sending the whole thing sky high with an outrageous joke, but at the same time it was completely respectful of the work and the world that the work represented. So it took the poetry seriously, it took the drama seriously, it took the character seriously. But it was not afraid to be completely irreverent about him. And, of course, Shakespeare is somebody who is, generally speaking, approached with a reverence that is afforded few other people, Michelangelo and a few others. You know what I mean? So the fact that one was free to imagine him as somebody who was just desperate to get his pants off and was refreshing. It was nice to know that who liked getting drunk, who it's not the way one thinks
who
of it.
Who would tell a lie.
And competitive and jealous and really pissed off when Marlowe comes up with a better title than the one he's managed to dream up. And so on. So
it doesn't seem so disrespectful to make him human, which is sort
that,
of what
well,
it's
that's
all
of course
done.
The point. That's right. What it did. It made him human and it made him approachable. And that was a kind of joy to see that actually – to see somebody also transcending themselves, which is one of the kind of hidden pleasures of it, both the actors in the play and him in terms of what he's writing. He suddenly is writing beyond himself and writing beyond his capability and beyond what he's known.
And I'd like to play a clip from the film that I really liked. Folks will remember this is really the climactic scene, I guess, in which the play Romeo and Juliet has been performed, and then the master of the revels, played here by Simon Callow, comes in to basically arrest everyone because they have committed the unspeakable sin or crime, I guess, of having a woman in the cast. And what no one realizes is that Queen Elizabeth herself is actually in attendance. Let's listen to this clip.
That woman is a woman!
What? A woman? You mean that goat?
I'll see you all in clink in the name of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth.
Mr. Tilney! Have a care with my name. You will wear it out. The Queen of England does not attend exhibitions of public lewdness, so something is out of joint. Come here, Master Kent. Let me look at you. Yes, the illusion is remarkable. And your error, Mr. Tilney, is easily forgiven. But I know something of a woman in a man's profession. Yes, by God, I do know about that.
That's from the film Shakespeare in Love, directed by my guest John Madden. And I have to say, it was interesting watching you listen to this film. You've heard that scene hundreds of times. It still brings you a smile.
It does. It does. I just think there's so much in it. There's so much in it. And the text is incredibly rich. And it was a joy to direct because of that.
And you had Judi Dench giving that memorable performance of Queen Elizabeth, for which she won the Best Supporting Actress Oscar that year.
That's right.
The film got 7 Oscars. Gwyneth Paltrow won for Best Actress. It was the Best Picture. Mm-hmm. And at some point, I pictured you on Oscar night watching people walk off with these Oscars in performances that you directed. And the film was your own. And you, who were nominated for Best Director, wondering, hey, where's mine?
I would have felt the same way, but it was a foregone conclusion in my mind that since we were competing in the year that contained Saving Private Ryan, which, was a formidably directed film, with the first 40 minutes of which sort of made movie history, I think, in a way, because it dealt with war, the shooting of war, in a way that, pushed the frontiers back. And Spielberg being Spielberg, I didn't really ever think that was likely. So I'd sort of relaxed on that one long ago. However, the thrill beyond all thrills, of course, is the fact that it won the Best Picture, because that's an award for everybody and everything. I didn't somehow get to take the piece of gold home, but it's not a worry to me, I have to say.
Tell me a little bit about Judi Dench and what you did to bring that performance from her, that memorable performance of Queen Elizabeth.
She's an actress that one grew up admiring. I mean, she was really ubiquitous in my youth. She was both an incredibly powerful force in the theater. She played, I'd seen her do countless Shakespearean roles, but she also was very well known from television work. And one had just admired her immensely. And she seemed like a kind of absolutely natural choice, if a rather daunting one, for Queen Victoria. She turns out, of course, to be the most absurdly approachable person. I mean, she's so not grand. She's so not the dame, what one would imagine when one hears the word dame. She's very mischievous and very open. She has a kind of, it was partly making me smile there listening to that clip. She has an extraordinary understanding of the dynamic of language, I think. I think one of the things that's amazing about her as an actress, the quality I always notice when she's on stage, the audience leans towards her when she comes on. It's quite an extraordinary effect. I've noticed it because I've watched out for it. She magnetizes people to her because they want to know her. They want to get close to her. There's something terribly available about her. But beyond that, she has an incomparable sense of the dynamic of how to wait a line. Just the simple line, Mr. Tilney, have a care with my name, you will wear it out. Just somebody might put a pause before you will wear it out, and the line would never work as well as it does in her mouth. It's such a glib example. But she just knows how to time things perfectly. She knows how to time things emotionally, comically. And she just, that's just one part of an extraordinary array of skills that she has.
You know, before I let you go, John Madden, I have to ask you one question, and that is about living with your name in America. and I ask this because I, my name, Dave Davies, as it happens, if you Google my name, the first 9,000 hits will be the lead guitarist for the Kinks,
right.
whose name I share.
Indeed.
Not that I bear any kind of fame in particular, but I've had to live with this
the name
in the shadow
is
of
you.
This guy. You bear the same name as a legendary football coach and now,
I do.
Who has a big hit video game. Has that affected your life? What's that been like?
Well, it affects my life every time I go to meet a limousine driver, which sounds very swanky, but you'll know that, you know, if you're in any kind of professional context where you're having to move around, there's generally a driver comes to meet you. And the number of times, so used to seeing the disappointed face when I appear, and they don't actually even believe it's me. I kind of point to their sign and say, yes, that's me. And they look kind of nonplussed because they're expecting this. I don't even know quite what he looks like, but I know he doesn't look like me. I think he's rather larger
than me.
He's a
big guy.
Isn't he?
Right.
So I get that. I get the jokes from the immigration officers when I come in, although, again, famously, he doesn't fly, does he?
Right.
So I don't quite know what their expectations there are. But I've never met him.
Well, you keep doing this good work, you will be more famous than him someday. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Director John Madden. His new film is Proof, starring Anthony Hopkins and Gwyneth Paltrow. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor Audio Courses, including The Great Good Book, The Bible and the Roots of Western Literature. Additional support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor Tom Wilkinson tells us about playing an upper-class lawyer in the new film Separate Lies. He also stars in The Exorcism of Emily Rose. And a review of the new film, Everything is Illuminated. Dave Davies filling in for Terry Gross. Tom Wilkinson is a British actor who impressed American movie audiences in 1997 with The Full Monty, where he played a laid-off factory manager who joins a ragged band of male strippers. He earned an Oscar nomination for the film In the Bedroom, where he and Sissy Spacek starred as a couple dealing with the murder of their only son. Wilkinson has been familiar to British TV and stage audiences for years, appearing with Helen Mirren in the Prime Suspect series and in many other roles. He began focusing on movies in the 90s, and his other film roles include Shakespeare in Love, The Patriot, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Batman Begins, and The Exorcism of Emily Rose.
Wilkinson stars in the new movie Separate Lies, which opens across the country September 30th. He plays James Manning, a high-powered British lawyer whose well-ordered life is shattered when he learns about his wife's infidelity and a hit-and-run accident which compels him to lie for his wife and her lover. Stephen Holden of the New York Times wrote, "Mr. Wilkinson nails every detail of this self-satisfied snob. The intimidating legal eagle glare that James directs at everyone, including his wife Anne, his oratorical speech that inflects even casual observations with an undertone of judgment." Here's a scene from Separate Lies in which Wilkinson and his wife, played by Emily Watson, are talking about what went wrong in their marriage.
"I've let you down, haven't I? I must have done, otherwise none of this would have happened."
"No, you haven't. It was my fault. I did it. I did everything. Can't we just leave it at that?"
No. We can't leave it. I need to understand it. Look, here am I thinking we are very happy, only to discover that on the contrary, we, or at any rate, you, are very unhappy."
"No."
"Well, what is it? Am I thoughtless? Am I unkind? Or is it something more prosaic? Am I a bad lover? Is that it? Is this up together mind? Does he give you more orgasms than I do?"
"No, he isn't. It's nothing like that."
"Well, what is it?"
"He's easy to be with. He doesn't seem to want anything from me."
"And that's good, is it?"
"Yes, it's good. It's very good. You have such standards, James. Whatever I do, I always feel that I am letting you down in some way, that I'm not measuring up, I'm getting it wrong, I'm disappointing you."
"And you don't disappoint him?"
"I don't think he cares enough either way. And that's just so relaxing."
"Oh, well, I'm sorry I'm not more relaxed. Killing someone seems to stick in my mind."
In Separate Lies, you play a powerful lawyer in a seemingly happy marriage, but who discovers all kinds of problems. What drew you to this role?
I like the idea of playing somebody from the upper middle class, because it's not something I do. It's not a class that I am. My background is much more sort of blue collar. So I thought it was a wonderful opportunity to play somebody from the upper middle class, you know, that's something I don't think I've really done much of before, and certainly not in this way. And I felt that Julian Fellowes, writer, director, had done a great job in sort of describing the kind of idyllic world that he was a part of at the beginning of the story. This wonderful kind of reassuring middle class world of, you know, wealth and security and beautiful chocolate box pretty England and all the things that he considers to be, you know, the cornerstones of his life. In fact, what he'd simply done, it turns out, is sort of build a prison for his wife. He thought he was bestowing upon her the sort of, you know, gifts of love and marriage and continuity and security, etc., etc. And what he'd simply done is imprisoned her. And I felt that a man sort of finding his way out of the prison that he's built for himself and his wife was an interesting story.
You know, and it's interesting because as you describe that, I'm picturing you in that role, and you convey this sense of privilege and power in little things, the way you stand, the way you hold a drink, the tone of your voice.
That's part of the business of acting, that you have to sort of figure out what it is that people find important. What are their values? What they want, above all, what it is that they want out of any given situation.
And this character, James Manning, the high-powered lawyer, what is it that he values? What does he want?
Well, I think he wants more of the same. One of the characteristics of that class, I am led to believe, is that they believe in continuity, but the continuity is not the continuity between now and the future. It's a continuity between the past and the future. They want things to be like they always have been. If it was good enough for my father and my grandfather, it's certainly good enough for me and good enough for my children. You know, that in a certain sense, they lead a rather unexamined life. And that's the sort of penalty that poor old James Manning pays when he realizes that his wife is being unfaithful to him. Because, of course, his first response would be, but why? She's got everything she needs. What could possibly motivate her to have an affair with this fellow, and so on and so forth. So it's that sort of, you know, the more you can establish somebody reveling in the things of his power and wealth and so on, the more you'll the more fun the audience will have watching him sort of looking again at his job and thinking, was this the best job I should be doing? Shouldn't I be doing something else? Was this the right house to be living in, or should I have lived at something? You know, seeing somebody sort of rebuild the sort of moral universe that has been shattered.
Well, it is fun to watch. Yeah, it is fun to watch. Yeah, yeah. You were born in England. Your dad was a farmer when you were young, and then you moved to Canada, I think, from ages 5 to 11, right? And then and then back to England, where your father pursued a number of different activities. And I'm wondering, you know, it's a pretty varied background, kind of what those travels might have exposed you to, or did that affect the kind of creative insight that you drew on in your career?
I'm not sure. The thing, what it creates, here's the situation. As far as my family are concerned, from my father's family and indeed my mother's, but my father's particularly, they were farmers in the same bit of England for 1,000 years. There is just no evidence that any member of my family was anything other than a farmer. And my grandfather was a farmer, my father was a farmer, and to all intents and purposes, had things turned out differently, I would have been a farmer, and my brothers would have been farmers. At the point, but what happened, of course, that this was kind of shattered. This sense of continuity was shattered completely. One reason or another, the farm went, and there was never any question that I was going to follow in my father's footsteps. So this sort of as it were, discontinuity, perhaps gave me a kind of rootlessness. There was no home. There was no nothing I could sort of return to. Nothing I could say, you know, that's the real me there. You know, I should be running the farm, but my brother is running the farm. There was no farm. There was nothing of that. So, and I think, in a certain sense, rootlessness, in that sense, is quite good for an actor. It's not necessarily going to make an actor, but it means they are much more wide-ranging in the things that they will allow themselves to be influenced by, that they're perhaps not as set in their cultural ways as perhaps they could be if they had had that thing which we crudely call a strong sense of themselves. An actor probably doesn't have a strong sense of himself in that sense, and I think probably that's one of the reasons.
Reinventing yourself, in effect, in life and on the stage, right?
Yes.
Actor Tom Wilkinson. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Wilkinson. He stars in the new film, Separate Lies. Wilkinson started his career on the British stage and on British television before moving into films. Well, in 1995, you were introduced to a much wider audience with the film The Full Monty. And to remind our audience, this is the story of a group of men who lose their jobs when their Sheffield steel plant closes, and one of them hatches upon this idea of creating a male strip team. This is a remarkable film, and it was hugely successful. But I can imagine when you looked at the script, you must have thought, my heavens, what is this? What was your reaction?
I had no hesitation whatsoever in doing this film. I read it, and the first time I read it, I thought, this is good. and I went to get it made. And it was a point in my career where I decided I'm going to stick with films. I'm not going to do any more television or theatre. I'm going to stick with films until I find out whether it's going to work for me or not. But with this one, I just simply had not the faintest hesitation in doing it.
What told you it was going to work? Because it seems to me so much of what works here is, I don't know, the chemistry, these guys, the way you all do it.
Yeah, well, the script itself is almost perfect. I mean, it was never changed from the day one filming to the time we finished. I think they added a couple of scenes sometime after, but just sort of general kind of fill-in scenes. But I thought the kind of the writing was wonderful and worked perfectly. But added to that, I thought it was one of the most brilliantly cast movies that I've ever seen. You know, there were lots of actors in it, none of whom I'd ever heard. Robert Carlyle I knew, but the rest of them I never heard of. And they turned out that they were just perfect for it. And that, together with, you know, all the rest of the kind of imponderables that go to making a film, it absolutely achieved what it set out to do.
Well, I wanted to talk about another role that you played, which was a real interesting part in an HBO film called Normal, in which you played a man in a small Illinois town who is married, mm-hmm. has two kids, is active in his church, works in a tractor factory, but who mm-hmm. eventually confronts the idea he believes he is in his heart a woman and wants a sex change operation. And I thought we'd play a clip here, and this is a scene very early in the film in which you, this man, and your wife, played by Jessica Lange, are getting marriage counseling from your minister, played here by Randall Arney. Let's listen.
I've been struggling with something for a long time. I prayed for years for it to go away, but it won't.
Go on.
I was born in the wrong body. I'm a woman. I've known it all my life.
Oh my gosh, Roy.
Good grief.
Roy, I don't know what to say.
No, I don't either, except I love her very much. The last thing I want to do is cause her any pain.
Roy, are you having an affair?
Oh, Irma, no.
Well, this doesn't make any sense.
Roy, I have to agree. I mean, you've been married to Irma for 25 years. You have two wonderful children, and suddenly, out of nowhere, you make this strange declaration?
It's not out of nowhere. I've been hiding it for years. It's been an agony. I can't go on living my life like this. I'd rather die.
Do you mean that?
Yes. Yes.
That was my guest, Tom Wilkinson, and Jessica Lange in the film Normal. That's a pretty remarkable scene. How did you prepare for that one? Do you recall shooting that?
I didn't prepare for it in the sense that you possibly mean in the question. I knew what was going to happen in the film. And what I really wanted to do was make that scene a scene which something that was of central importance to this guy's existence, but this is the first time he'd ever talked about it. I mean, it's self-evident that that is what the scene is about. And so it is. I mean, in fact, because of the way we filmed it, the tremendous outpouring of emotion that was present in that scene, that I felt was present, happened a little bit in the earlier takes than the ones that you saw there, because it slightly took me by surprise that, you know, something that you thought, well, this is something that he's not talked, this is bottled up. This is something that he's saying for the first time in his life. And it's of such central importance to him that it means so much. And anyway, the fact of the matter is, it's a tremendously kind of emotional scene. And I knew that would happen. There was just something that has happened in the last few years about my ability, years ago, when I used to do scenes where I was required to weep, I couldn't do it at all. And now I've turned into John Gielgud. I can weep I can weep at anything, you know. So, but I knew that would happen in that scene, and it did.
Looking at this scene a second time, I was fascinated watching you in the moments before you revealed this secret, where you and your wife and the minister are talking about other things that might be bothering you, headaches, pressure at work, and we can see you as a guy who's figuring out whether he wants to just paper things over for another day or whether he is going to reveal this shocking fact about himself. And I was reminded of something that I read Todd Field, the director of In the Bedroom, said about you, which was that it was fascinating to watch you when you're not speaking or when you don't have much to do in a scene. And I was thinking that a lot of what was interesting about that scene was your expressions. That you could see this guy struggling with this decision. Do I just pretend it's okay, tell a superficial story, or spill it out? What goes on in your head when you're not talking?
Yeah. Acting, for me, is, as I get older, even simpler than it was when I first started out, is that basically what you have to do is adopt completely and absolutely the point of view of the character you're playing. And that, what that liberates you to do, I think, is to, and I don't want to get technical and boring and actorish and stupid about it, it just means that you are that character all the time when you're doing the scene. As soon as it stops, you're back to who you are. But while you're in it, you're allowed to, you're thinking what the character is thinking. You are, you know, and part of also the strategy of acting, and there's something else that's quite technical, is don't give stuff away. Don't play the end before the beginning. One of the things that you want to do in the course of a performance is make every little new direction, a new twist and turn, a surprise. Now, if you'd have seen my character looking doomed at the beginning of the scene, the audience would have been prepared for something weird. That you'd think, what? Something weird is going on with that guy. Ooh, I better watch it. But if you see a guy who's going along with his wife's sort of notion of a little tune-up, nothing important, and indeed, perhaps he himself is trying to put off the big moment that he can't, and it isn't put off until the instant he's saying it is when he sort of makes the decision that that's what he's going to say. So that's always what I would say to any kind of actor or, you know, anybody who aspires to something in the narrative arts. Don't give the end away when you're doing the beginning. You got to do, you know, surprise is perhaps the storyteller's greatest weapon.
You've had a lot of these interesting roles. I mean, that is one where you're a woman trapped in a man's body. I mean, the Full Monty in the Bedroom. How do you decide which roles you will take? What are you drawn
to? It's simple, Dave. You just follow your nose. You ask those simple, really instinctive questions like, you know, can I shine in this role? Can I do this role better than anybody in the world? Is there something in it that I recognize? Nothing, you know, it's not really not to do with the money or the director or the other members of the cast. But the first simple thing is, am I going to enjoy playing this character? And it's childish, I know. And I shouldn't, from my great age, be admitting to something so sort of, you know, do I like the look of this toy? Or am I going to wait to the next toy shop and see if there's something even cuddlier? No. That's how it works. It's purely instinctive decision.
Well, Tom Wilkinson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Dave. It's been a pleasure.
Actor Tom Wilkinson. He's starring in The Exorcism of Emily Rose and with Emily Watson in Separate Lies, which opens across the country next week. Coming up, a review of the new film, Everything is Illuminated. This is Fresh Air. Jonathan Safran Foer's acrobatic first novel, Everything is Illuminated, was published in 2002 to rave reviews and went on to become a surprise bestseller. Now it's been adapted for the screen by the actor Liev Schreiber. Our film critic David Edelstein has a review.
It's no big news that dense, unwieldy novels often lose their souls in translation to film. So even if Everything is Illuminated doesn't click, you have to give points to the writer and director, Liev Schreiber, for taking on Jonathan Safran Foer's jigsaw epic, a smart-alecky collage of mangled English and faux Jewish folktale that takes all one's powers of concentration to follow, let alone interpret. Foer was born in 1977, two worlds away from the shtetls of Eastern Europe and the Holocaust that wiped out the last of them. And you can feel him trying every color on his palette, every string on his klezmer violin, to summon a dead or repressed past into the living present. Schreiber is best known as an actor, and he has chosen in his first feature to seize on the modern-day Odyssey part of the novel, the one with the obvious Holocaust hook, and find a wide, straight path to the big themes. The movie begins as a bouncy three-man odyssey. The narrator is Alex, played by the Ukrainian-American punk musician Eugene Hutz. Alex lives with his family in Odessa and helps run a company that specializes in driving rich Jews around the Ukrainian countryside in search of their lost heritage. His client is one Jonathan Safran Foer, played by Elijah Wood. Foer wants to locate a village called Trockenbrod and the woman he thinks saved his late grandfather from the Nazis. Alex's grandfather, played by Boris Leskin, is their driver. He's dyspeptic and anti-Semitic, and the question bubbles up, what did he do in the war? Much of Everything is Illuminated consists of these three men in a battered old car, plus a manic mutt named Sammy Davis Jr., Jr., after the grandfather's favorite American entertainer. If you've seen Jim Jarmusch's Down by Law, you'll recognize the mixture of deadpan and malapropism in Alex's conversation with Foer.
How much currency would the first rate accountant receive in America?
I don't know. A lot, probably, if he or she is good.
She?
Or he?
Are there Negro accountants?
Yes, there are African-American accountants, but you don't want to use that word.
And homosexual accountants?
Well, there are homosexual everythings. There are homosexual garbage men.
And how much currency would Negro homosexual accountant receive?
You really shouldn't use that word.
Which word?
The N-word. It's not the N-word, but...
Negro?
Yeah, that one.
But they take them all away. They're premium people.
That's good stuff. And Hutz's Alex dominates the movie with his hip-hop cadences and strangely illuminating bad English. But there isn't much urgency here, and Schreiber's direction is relentlessly coy. He loves marooning objects in the center of symmetrical frames, and he even resorts to dog reaction shots. That lusty, witty klezmer soundtrack made me laugh out loud for about half an hour, until I realized it was ironing out all the dissonances, killing the sense of mystery we should feel in this Ukrainian countryside with its buried secrets. I started wishing it was hunting season on klezmer bands. There's nothing wrong with Elijah Wood's Foer, except he's not a dramatic character. He wears huge glasses and dark suits and walks like a robot or one of the Men in Black. In the novel, he's a writer, but in the film he calls himself a collector, and methodically bags and tags every item that reminds him of something, a piece of boiled potato, a grasshopper, a handful of soil. The woman at the end of his odyssey is also a collector, except on a much vaster scale. Her boxes hold the history and culture of a place that's now extinct. What a payoff this might have been. The idea of collection gestures toward all the great themes, the elusiveness of memory and history, the importance of storytelling, both to sift through and distill our past. But Schreiber doesn't know how to get these themes into our bloodstream, so the movie remains abstract and rather closed. When the so-called illumination comes and the secret is revealed, and by the way, it's a different secret than in the novel, it's both horrific and surprisingly banal. Schreiber has adapted Four's Everything is Illuminated prudently, but I'm not sure the words prudent and four belong in the same sentence. Better an insane, inchoate fiasco than a self-consciously artistic mood piece that illuminates nothing.
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Клей момент купил за рубли, пакет к нему купил. Надышавшись этой дури, музыку я полюбил. Где же вы, родители? Куда же смотрит школа? Так я стал звездою рок-н-ролла. Зиппо, триппер, пистолет, а мы играем в семилет. Зиппо, триппер, пистолет, а мы играем в семилет. Опа! Одноклассницу девчонку к себе в гости пригласил. Папа с мамой на работе, мы ебемся, что есть сил. Где же вы, родители? Куда же смотрит школа? Так я стал звездою рок-н-ролла. Зиппо, триппер, пистолет, а мы играем в семилет. Зиппо, триппер, пистолет, а мы играем в семилет.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, and from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or a video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the King of Blues. We celebrate B.B. King's 80th birthday. Join us for the next Fresh Air.